So, anyone have any questions on homework 5? And does anybody know when the final is? So, take one thing at a time. Was that a question on homework 5?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. I have two questions.
What was your break?
I can't remember what directed or undirected meant.
Okay. Directed is when there's an arrow, like one-way streets, and undirected is when you can go either way along an edge.
Wait, undirected is when?
Undirected is when there's no direction to the edges. And directed means you can only go in one direction. There's directed edges. That way.
Okay. And then, I don't know if you're doing specific questions, but for number 3C, I was kind of.
What's number 3?
What's the question?
Yeah.
It just says like if you roll a dice until you get 1.
Oh, C? Part C? Is that what you're asking about? Sure. This is homework 5. Okay, sure. I should be able to find that. I roll a die until I get a 1, then until I get a 2, then until I get a 3, then until I get a 4, then until I get a 5, and then I pick how many times an average will I roll all together? Is that the question? Is that the one you want to hear about? Okay, so can you answer the first part? How many times do you roll a die until you get a 1 on average?
1 out of 6.
So the probability is 1 out of 6. And what I mentioned in class, and that you actually need that for all these questions, is the following fact. If there's an event that comes up with probability, say, p, then the expected number of times before it happens is 1 over p. So if the probability is 1 out of 6, it takes on average 6 times before it happens, which is very intuitive. But it turns out that mathematically it's actually correct.
Well, I thought it was 36.
Well, so to get the 1, you mean to get the first 1 is 36? Yes, it is 36. Because it's 6 to get the first, on average, 6 to get the first one, and then another 6 to get the second one, and then another 6 to get the third one, another 6 to get the fourth one, fifth, sixth, 6 times 6, 36.
Oh, so like for the second
one.
Yeah, but we can't do it in the homework already.
Of course. But I am still taking late ones until Wednesday.
Oh.
Okay.
So that's how we're supposed to do that.
Yeah, so they're all basically that, right? So what's the probability that something happens, and then 1 over that is the expected number of times that it happens.
I have a question.
Shoot.
I wrote you an email, too, about the no incoming length, no outgoing length.
Right. You didn't like my answer?
It being worded like that.
It being, uh-huh.
So that would mean, like, a source is no incoming length.
Right.
Means
there's no arrows pointing out.
Outgoing.
Pardon me?
For a source, we're only looking for outgoing.
For something's a source if it has no incoming links.
Which means it's outgoing.
Not necessarily. It could have no links at all. Mm-hmm. Right? Just a node just sitting there with nothing connected to it is technically a source. Kind of a stupid source because it doesn't go anywhere, but it's still a source. Mm-hmm. In this case, everything's connected to everything, but it looks like everyone has an incoming arrow, right? This one has
Which
an incoming
means
arrow.
The answer would be nothing. Like, could be none.
Could be, sure. That would be a valid answer.
All right, I see that.
Could even be correct.
Okay.
But there are sinks here, right?
Right.
Okay.
For it to be like directed or undirected, is every single one undirected?
Every single one.
You said, like,
So this is a graph.
Okay.
And there's nodes, which in this case are the shapes, and there's edges, which are the little arrows. If the arrows have pointy parts on them, then it's directed. And otherwise, if any of the arrows in the graph have a pointy thing on them, then it's a directed graph. Every undirected graph is basically a directed graph. Right? If you think of a two-way street, you can think of it as two one-way streets that are occupying the same space.
So what would be like an undirected?
An undirected graph would be like a bunch of intersections in a city that are connected by two-way streets. That would be a good undirected graph. Subway stops. Every pair of stops that has tracks going between them, the tracks go in both directions, so it's undirected. There's no one way, you can only go across this edge in one direction but not the other. right? These arrows here mean something, right? They tell you this is actually a flowchart, right? So you're actually supposed to go around following the arrows, making little decisions as you go. So the directions are important. It doesn't, it's not meaningful to go back along an edge. So this would be a directed graph because the edges have direction to them. Still no. You want a picture of it? I mean, generally, I draw graphs, most of us draw graphs like this. You have a bunch of nodes, and then you can have links between them. That would be an undirected graph because all the edges are undirected. There's no arrowheads on them.
Oh. So you don't know which way you're going.
You don't know. You're allowed to go either way, is what it means.
Oh.
But if you're at some node, you're here, you can go along this edge and come here, but you can also go back along the edge. They're not. Okay, good. All right, good. Then I will commence with a couple of questions.
What do you need to
do? Oh, that was, yes, that was another question, wasn't it? So the website that's supposed to, at Rutgers, that supposedly says this, I couldn't access uselessly. But Google had a cached version of it, which, according to my reading, said that we were having our exam December 20th. But I was hoping that you guys were better at this than me, having taken more final exams at Rutgers than I had. Unless you're a freshman, in which case, we're even. Nobody, did anybody check? Anybody try to check? Did anybody try to check and couldn't figure it out? That's basically where I am. When is our final? I don't decide this, right? There's a table that all classes that meet at a certain time will have their final on such and such a day. And the problem is that, first of all, I couldn't access Rutgers' page that has the information. And second of all, when I found a copy of it, it didn't have our exact time. It had our class, but shifted by, I think, half an hour earlier. Now, it could be that that's when the classes are officially on the college out campus. And when they're over here, they're shifted by half an hour, so they're talking about the same slot. But I just felt very uneasy not seeing the official time.
So you're not going to do it during class time?
Correct. The final has its own special time set aside for the finals. I need all the classes in that. As it is, I'm going to skip one of the chapters in the book. Okay? So, all right. So if I will continue to double check this, but at the moment, let's say tentatively, I believe that the final is supposed to be December 20th on Wednesday.
Noon to 3. Though presumably I won't take quite that long. Oh, the other thing is, do you remember that word that I said was on a web page that I made up?
Yeah.
Do you remember what the word was?
No.
That was a yes and a no said at the same time, wasn't it?
Rutgers?
No, Rutgers is all over the web, it turns out.
Schrachter or something?
Schrachter? Okay, good. Do you remember? No. We'll take that as a no. All right, let me, I think I wrote it on the page.
No, it's R-U-K-I-S, I thought.
No.
I thought it was like Schill.
Here it is. Scarchel, people, Scarchel! Where's your vocabulary? All right, we're going to now search for Scarchel. Now remember, if you remember, you know, nothing up my sleeve, last time when we asked Google about this, Google said, Scarchel? You're high. There's no such word. But now, holy mackerel. All right, this is different than the last time I checked. Apparently, there are now 7 hits on this word.
The first of which is on the page where I put it. The second of which is on my page where whenever I search for something and it only comes up once, I put it on that page, my Google Whack page. So now, of course, now it appears twice. It's not a Google Whack anymore. But then apparently, I never saw this before, but there's now something called Scarchel that's showing up in other pages on Wikipedia.
No,
it's not the Wikipedia.
It's not the Wikipedia. You're right. It is something in Slovakia or something. I don't know. Some country, SK. Simlovic.sk/Wikipedia/English, because you know Scarchel. commons.media.org.
So it's all over the place now. We've started something. It's a trend. I have no idea why it says Scarchel. It looks like it's trying to be a name.
Taking the risk going to an unknown website.
Yes, that's true. It's not on this page. But maybe it's in Google's cache.
Oh, I know this.
What is it? Do I not want to know? Is it dirty?
No, it's... Go ahead.
Do you want me to click on Scarchel? But you said that it's dangerous to do that. It's saying it will create a page about Scarchel. It has no idea what Scarchel is. It has no page for this. So what are you thinking? All right, fine. Anway, the point is that it now knows about Scarchel, and it now knows about this page. It took a little while for it to find it by tracing links in the graph that is the web. All right, that being said, we're going to do clicker stuff. Sure.
Sorry.
No problem. I got your email.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I didn't read it, but I got it. I will read it. I was kind of coming back from New York.
Can I have the one that I always use for the
I don't know which one you want.
Like the 006.
You have a pet clicker.
What?
You have a pet clicker.
Well, this way I use it every time, so. Do you want one? Is that
good? Did I get your email? Was it a homework? Yeah, I think I got it.
I texted again, and I asked you to email me back if you got it.
I will.
Okay.
I was driving back from New York.
Oh.
All right, that being said, where is the clicker stuff? Oh, there it is. Okay, very good. All right. Very good. Here's what we got. All right, so... I gave a couple examples last time. I talked about the halting problem and self-reference and how we understand computation. The thing, there's no way we're going to be doing halting problem proofs in this class. I mean, I think that they're of limited value and they're really hard. So the little thing that I'd like you to be able to do is look at a piece of code and solve the halting problem for that piece of code. So I gave some examples last time, but probably if I didn't ask you about it, so I can presume that you actually didn't really understand. So here's our first chance at actually forcing ourselves to see if we can make sense out of this. So here's the game. This is a Python program. Defining, we'll call it P1, is some subroutine that we're defining. It takes some number n as input, and here's what it does. As long as the n that has come in is bigger than 10, it's going to print that n, and then it's going to change to another value of n, one that's one smaller. N equals n minus 1 means take n, subtract 1 from it, and store it back into n. Right? So take whatever n is and make it one smaller. So it's counting down. Then, since we're in a while loop, it's going to continue to do this as long as this condition holds true. While means as long as this holds true, keep doing these statements. So it's going to take n, it's going to count it down, and if n, as long as n is greater than 10, it will continue to do this. If it stops being greater than 10, the thing will stop. So now here's the question. P1 of n halts for which of the following? When is this actually going to stop? Is it going to stop no matter what the initial value of n is? Keep in mind, this is the initial value of n. N changes during the subroutine. But we're asking here about the initial value of n. All initial values of n, only initial values of n that are less than 10, only initial values of n that are equal to 10, only initial values of n that are bigger than 10, or it never stops. It's always going to go into an infinite loop no matter what the value of n is. So in your head, sort of go through these steps. Try to figure out what will happen. If n starts out as each of these different possibilities, will it ever get to a point where it stops, or will it run forever? So, when does it halt? So, try that, and then I'll explain the answer, and then you can ask me some questions if it's not clear. I have to think about this, too.
Does it stop?
For which values, then, is it going to eventually stop? Yeah, that's what halt is. It's not... Speaking of halting, sorry about that.
I don't think that's official records policy right now. So
It's not.
We didn't have a class. We didn't have any kind of threshold. Like if you missed more than this number of classes,
you're
starting.
Oh, okay. I thought if you were like going to the rest.
I said that I will let you miss 3 classes without taking anything off of your quicker grade.
Oh, you just get credit for being here and answering the questions.
Meanwhile, a couple more people need to click in. Give you 5, maybe 5 more seconds?
Yeah,
oh, okay, so I won't count. Would you like a sample one? And then you can email me and say, all right, just give it back when you're done. Person, you just read it. You at least show up on the board this way. Tell me when you click. There. Was that you? All right, beauty. 3, 2, 1, stopping. All right, so here's the game. We've got some, everybody's over here. Maybe I'll write on this side of the board. Maybe there's no chalk. All right, so at least as far as the question's concerned, whether you're bigger or less than 10 seems really important. So let's think about this. So let's start off with, imagine that the initial value of n is something less than 10. Call it 3. If n comes in 3, it says while 3 is greater than 10, oh wait, 3 is not greater than 10. It does nothing. It halts right away. So it will always halt if n is less than 10. If the initial value of n is less than 10. What if it's equal to 10? If n is equal to 10, so we'll keep track of this. A, B, C, D, E. We know that it definitely halts if n is less than 10. So that means it's not E, right? It's not no values of n will make it halt. Anything less than 10, it will halt. What if it's equal to 10? If it's equal to 10, put 10 in here. While n is equal to 10, while 10 is greater than 10, is 10 greater than 10? No, so it won't do this. It just halts right away. So it also halts if the initial value of n is equal to 10. All right, what happens if n is something bigger than 10? Say 12. 12 is bigger than 10. What will it do if n is 12? So if the initial value of n is 12, it's going to say while 12 is bigger than 10, yeah, 12 is bigger than 10, print 12. So it's going to actually print the number 12 on the screen. Then it's going to take 12 minus 1 is 11 and assign that to n. So n is now 11. The initial value was 12, but it's now 11. It's going to go back up, try the while loop again. Is 11 bigger than 10? Yes. It's going to print 11. 11 minus 1 is 10. It stores that back in n. N is now equal to 10. Goes back up to the top of the while loop. Is 10 bigger than 10? No. It'll stop. Okay. So if the input n were 12, it's going to print 12, 11, and then halt. So it halts. We know it halts if n is equal to 12. What about, we're not going to now try every different number. There are, a lot of them. But what if it were like 100? Is it going to halt?
Yeah.
What makes you think that? That was a very fast answer, unless you went 100, 99, 98.
It's
going to
be going down.
So if it's a big number, what this says is if you're a big number, we're going to make you one smaller. Right? And so 100 will go down to 99, it'll go down to 98.
I thought that.
That's right.
And then
it does halt for n is equal to 10, but in fact it halts for all values of n. So this is the thing, I tried to do this with the group last semester also, and this is the piece that kind of kept going through, slipping through people's fingers. So I'm going to say it again. At least we'll get it. I don't know about the downloaders, but at least we'll get it. I'm asking about the initial value. If the initial value is something big, this loop will cause it to count down. It will eventually stop. Okay, so in fact, it halts for smaller than 10, equal to 10, bigger than 10. No matter how it starts off, it will always halt. So the correct answer here is A. All values of n will make this halt. And we'll contrast this with something else in a moment, but that's, at least for this one, that's the way it plays out. Oh, sorry. Oh. I'm playing hide and seek with the window. Does anybody?
Didn't show up.
It didn't show up. It wasn't just me. Here's my theory. I got a theory. There we go. All right. So where did we peak? We peaked on C and D. People didn't like A so much, which is, somebody got it. Nice. All right. So any other questions about this now that you've seen one of these? Let me show you another one.
Another one of these things, and I'm going to keep doing it until we get it right. All right. This is program two.
Program two is a little different from program one, but not very.
But enough that you need to think about it.
So what are we saying here now? It also takes in n. It also has a loop that says some condition on n. This is saying, as long as n is still bigger than or equal to 10, repeat the following steps. Prints n, and then n gets 1 gets added to it, and then stored back in n. Right? This block gets repeated in the while loop as long as this condition is true. So now the question is, the same choice as before. Is this going to halt no matter what the initial value of n is? Only if it's smaller than 10, it's equal to 10, it's bigger than 10, or it'll never ever halt. It's always going to go into an infinite loop and just keep doing the while loop over and over and over again, because this condition will never become true. Okay?
Give that one a whack. Got 15, 16 hits. I'm gonna stop in 3, 2, 1, we're out. All right,
so give me a number, and I'm gonna check if it halts for that number. Give me some number.
11.
All right, so what happens if this is 11? If we start off, if we say P2 of 11, so n starts out as 11, while n is bigger than or equal to 10, in this case 11 is bigger than or equal to 10, it will print 11, then it's going to make n 1 bigger than it was. 11 plus 1 is 12, it's going to store that back in n, it goes back up to the while loop. Is 12 bigger than or equal to 10? Mm-hmm. Sure. It's even more bigger than or equal to 10. It's going to print 12, it's going to increment n, it's going to make it 1 bigger, it goes up to 13, it goes back up to the while loop. 13 bigger than 10? Yes. Is it ever going to not be bigger than or equal to 10? No, it's going to get a bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger number. This will never stop for when we start out. So 11, it goes into an infinite loop.
So it's A.
We don't know yet. We know that it halts. No, it can't be A. A says it stops no matter what. And we already have one example where it doesn't stop. It could be E. It could be that no matter what number we give it, it won't stop. But we haven't checked enough numbers yet. Let's try something else. What else would be useful? We tried 11.
Couldn't be like it'll halt for anything that's less than 10 because it won't even like.
Well, let's try. Let's just give me a number less than 10.
Six.
Okay, so let's try for 6. If it starts off as 6, then it's going to say while 6 is greater than or equal to 10, it's not. It just isn't. So that loop ends right away, it terminates. So if we give it 6 to start, it does not go into a loop. It halts right away. So now we know that it halts for a particular value that's less than 10. That actually would be enough to get us the right answer. But let's just make sure that we really understand this. What's happening here? Any number that's less than that's strictly less than 10, it'll just stop right away. Anything that's 10 or more, what's going to happen? It's going to survive this loop, and then the number's going to get bigger. It's going to keep testing this condition, and it's just going to we're going to get numbers that are bigger and bigger and bigger than 10. So what's happening here is if we give it any number that's small, it stops right away. But as soon as we hit 10, everything changes. A number that's if you input a number that's equal to 10, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and never stops.
I have a question.
Sure.
If n equals n plus 1, what's the consensus? Where the definition part? that means it wouldn't halt, right?
Well, wait, let me take this one. I'm not sure I understand the question. Let me take it one step at a time. This here is not asking a question, right? This isn't saying, does n equal n plus 1? This is saying, take n, add 1 to it, and this equal sign means store it into n. Change the value of n. This equal sign here is actually a test. It's actually asking, is n bigger than or equal to 10? So now I ask your question again.
Right, I'm saying, let's say it was 6, right?
Of n is 6 coming in. Uh-huh.
And then it says, while n equals greater than
okay.
And it would have printed.
That's right.
Now, what if that n equals n plus 1 wasn't indented? Would it just do 6 plus 1 and then it would do 7 and then start over?
Well, if it weren't indented.
If it wasn't under the while.
If it weren't under the while, then it wouldn't be part of the loop. It wouldn't go back to the beginning.
Oh.
Right? The loop is it's saying do the stuff.
But it would still come up with an answer. It wouldn't fall. Right?
Well, let's change it. We'll say def. J1 for you. All right, so, and so what do you want it to be? Do you want to start off with the n equals n plus 1, or do you want to do the while loop?
No, I want to do the other one.
All right, like while n is bigger than or equal to 10, like that?
Yeah.
Print n.
And then I still want the n to be like...
And now, out here we put n equals n plus 1.
Yeah, so technically it's not part of it.
That's right, it's not in the loop. Mm-hmm. All right, what this will do, this will halt on all inputs. Because what's going to happen, that's not true. If n is bigger than or equal to 10, it's going to print that number forever. It's going to print the number and then go back and say, well, how about now? Is n still bigger than or equal to 10? Yeah, of course, it hasn't changed. It will just continue to print n over and over and over again. If we started off with a number like 6, it's going to test the condition. The condition fails, it won't do the loop. Then it will increment n, so n is now 7. But then that's the end of the program, so it stops. Alright, we good? Let's see if we're good. I have my doubt. So this one, the answer is, it halts if n is less than 10. So that's B. Oh good, okay, very nice. That was definitely the majority answer. Alright, do I have one more of these? P3, yes, alright. Here's P3. Now there's one little extra trick in here that I want to bring to your attention. This looks a lot like the other one. P3 takes n as input, there's a while loop, and now it's testing a condition. The double equal sign means, are these equal, yes or no? This is a Boolean comparison. This is saying, does n equal n plus 1? Does whatever value you have, is it the same value as if you add 1 to it? Okay. If that's true, then it does this loop. It prints n, and then makes n equal to n, then it increments n, adds 1 to n, stores it back in n. And goes and repeats the loop. Okay? So now the same question, which values of n does this halt for? Friends after the war. Like I never want to, but if you don't got it. I know. I just can't stop myself. Like I know in my head, I don't even want to put them there. It's just I look at what I typed and there were friends.
Too much C. Support.
Too much vitamin C. Yeah, right. All right, is that everybody, I think? No. Okay. Give you 5 more. 3, 2, 1, stopping. All right, so what's the trick here before I go and step through everything? Does anyone have a solid sense of how this is supposed to work, this example?
No.
Okay. Well, not no one, you're saying you don't. It's possible that someone does.
What is equal to equal to?
Equal means we're comparing, we're asking the question, are these equal?
I have a question.
Sure. Sure.
So once you go through it, is A still equal to the first n that you use? Like, is like 11 equal to 10, are you saying? Or is 11 equal to 11?
Well, in this comparison. Yeah. Right, so this comparison is just, it's a question. We're asking the question, if we start off with 11, if n is 11, we're saying, is 11 equal to 11 plus 1? In other words, 12. Is 11 equal to 12? And the answer would be, not so much, not the way we do normal math, right? So that the answer will be no, so this is false.
I mean,
what did he say? Not so much. Does he say that a lot? That's funny. No, I haven't seen it yet. I just saw the commercials. We're saying not a lot more in my house now, because that was really funny. He's doing his blah.
Not.
Nah. This is my. I can't make my son eat anymore. He'll just sit there and do that over and over again. And that was just for the ad. I'm afraid to show him the actual movie. So this is a silly. No one would ever write something like this because this is a very silly thing to say. And no number is ever equal to that number plus one. This will never hold true. This loop will never happen. It will halt for all values. But what I was trying to do is get you to understand, and if you didn't understand it right away, that's okay, because the point of showing you this was to say that this is different from this. These, they look the same, and you might even say them out loud the same, but they're very different. This is asking, does n equal n plus 1? And this is telling the computer to take n plus 1 and store it in n. They look the same, but they mean something very, very different. This is changing the value of n. This is a command. This is asking about the value of n. It's a function. An expression, value. Alright? Did that help a little bit?
Yep.
Alright. Now if I turn this to does not equal, if we said, well, n does not equal n plus 1, and then I had whatever was in here, that will run forever because n will always be not equal to n plus 1. Right? We can't talk about infinities, right? So there's no number that is equal to itself plus 1. Alright, so this should have been A, it should halt for all values, which was better than half. Interestingly, most people who got it wrong had the opposite. That it never halts. Why? Because we told that n is equal to n plus 1. But that's not what it means, right? This is asking about whatever the current value of n is. This is telling it to change the current value of n. All right. Enough of this foldy roll. I'm going to ask a question like this on the homework, just to or one or two like this, and then I'll have one on the final like that as well. We talked a little bit about infinities. I don't know why I put this in. Which infinite set is the biggest? The evens, the integers bigger than 0, the number of fractions between 0 and 1, the number of decimals between 0 and 1, or the integers bigger than minus 1,000. When I was talking about Cantor's proof, I mentioned this. Give you the 45 seconds, so 5 more seconds. Just put in something random if you don't have anything in yet. All right, so this I'll never ask you about again. According to the definition of sizes of infinite sets that I talked about in the last lecture, the evens, the integers bigger than 0, the fractions between 0 and 1, the integers bigger than minus 1,000, they're all the same size infinity. The only one that's any different from those is the decimals between 0 and 1, and there's more of them. So the correct answer would be D. Boy, I would think if you were not getting, like between B and E, I figured people would pick E, right? There's more integers bigger than minus 1,000 than there are bigger than 0. Because you have all of these plus negative 1,000 is 0. All right, anyway. Not important for this class.
Just curious who was paying attention.
So it was a D, right?
It was D, correct. All right, now since the last lecture was all about self-reference, I thought I'll make a self-referential multiple choice question. So given that there is one, there can only be one right answer, which is it? I need the paper to figure this one out. It's going to just give the last one. Yeah, but this, what I mean here, there can be only one, is if you think that there's two that are right, then something's not good. Right. You have to come up with an answer that, because it's right, it's the only thing that's right.
So that also means all the others are false.
All the others have to be false, right?
And if you don't think about the others being false, you won't be able to choose which one's correct.
All right, just clunk something in if you want to get the point fraction. I'm going to go 5 more seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right, so here's how I look at this. Let's start with C. If C is the right answer, then what does that mean? It means neither A, B, C, D, or E is the right answer, which means if C is the right answer, then C is not the right answer, and that would be a contradiction. So that can't be right. What about A? If A is the right answer, it says that B is the wrong answer. If B is the wrong answer, well, then it contradicts itself. Well, B is wrong. Then this is the right answer ends up being, so that's okay, that's cool. What else? It also means that D is wrong. Ah. So if that's the more interesting thing, if A is right, then that means that.
Doesn't mean that D is right.
It would mean that D is right, but it also would mean that D is wrong. Right? It simultaneously says that D is true and not D is true. D must be true because D says A was the right answer, so that would be correct. But we also said that only one of them can be right. And so the fact that A is right means D has to be wrong, which means that A has to be wrong. So we get into a loop and we're stuck, and that's not good. All right, so it can't be A, it can't be C. What about D? D says that A is the right answer, implies that A is the right answer, which of course gets us into trouble because we already showed that if A is the right answer, then D is also the right answer. And then that would mean that they're both right answers and there can only be one. So that's not good either. All right.
And then if A is the right answer and B is wrong, then that means B is not the right answer.
That's okay, because B asserts that it itself is correct. And if that's wrong, that doesn't get us into any trouble. But what if B is right? All right, let's say that B is the right answer. If B is the right answer, that would mean that B is wrong is wrong, so A is not the right answer. We already know that C is not the right answer. If B is the right answer, then D is out, and A is out, so that's okay. But there'd be also reason to think that E would be the right answer. Well, that's okay, right? Because it's wrong. If B is the right answer, then E saying that E is the right answer is wrong, so E's not the right answer. So we don't get into any trouble if we assume that B is the right answer. So that could be right. What about E? If we assume that E is the right answer, then E is the right answer, then A has to be wrong, which means that saying that B is the wrong answer must be wrong, so B must be the right answer.
So if E is the right answer, then B is also the right answer. But that gets us into trouble because there can only be one. So it can't be E. So the right answer is B.
Sure.
I'm just saying that self-reference can get you into all kinds of trouble. All right, yeah, so E is reasonable, but that the only problem with E is that if E is true, then B is also true, and there can only be one. All right, enough of that fol-de-rol. Let us move on. All right, so here's what I'd like to do today is talk about compression. So the issue is whenever computers work with all kinds of different information, and whenever they do so, that information has to be represented in the computer. And since really all the computer is manipulating is bits, whatever it is that the computer is going to work with has to be turned into bits. And it turns out that there's lots of different ways of representing things in the real world by bits. And in particular, we have these two competing interests that are actually very important. One is we'd like to represent things in bits in a way that makes it really easy to work with them. On the other hand, we'd also like to represent complicated things in the computer out of bits that makes them short, so that we don't need a lot of bits, because the shorter they are, the less storage space they take up, the less disk space they take up, the less time it takes to transmit them from one place to another. So we'd like them to be short, but we would like them also to be relatively direct. So it's not a simple question of how do you go about representing things. So what I'm going to do is talk about an idea that is not described in the book directly, but he talks around it a little bit. I'm just going to talk more directly at it. But if you want more details about how this works, there is a Wikipedia page on this topic, so you can read that for background reading. So let's start off with here's what I'm going to focus on: Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. So this is the whole thing. It's not really long. It's very famous, but it's not really short either. If you're going to represent this in the computer, you'd like to make it as compact as you can. So, just to make this example as simple as we can, I'm going to get rid of any uppercase letter, just pretend it's lowercase. So, if we go and count up the number of each character that appears in the speech, we get this. We get 282 spaces, 4 line breaks, 22 commas, 15 dashes, 10 periods, no question marks, 102 letter A's, and so forth. No letter Z's appear in the Gettysburg Address, but there are 10 Y's. It is very wise. So we need to come up with a way of representing the Gettysburg Address. And what we're going to focus on right now is each letter is going to get some bit pattern. And the way that we're going to represent the whole Gettysburg Address is by sticking those bit patterns one after the other. So here's in fact how it's represented most of the time. There's a standard representation for characters, and it's standard everywhere in the world except for in Microsoft, where it's almost this, but a little different. But anyway, each character, each letter or symbol, number, punctuation mark, has its own 8-bit code, an 8-bit pattern of zeros and ones, so that each character that you want to represent in the computer has its 8-bit code, and every 8-bit code corresponds to some character. It's known as ASCII, pronounced ASCII, which is something like American Standard Code for Information Interchange. And so if we're going to represent the Gettysburg Address in ASCII, there are 1,482 characters that make it up. So we need 8 bits for each of those characters for a total of 11,856. Okay. We get 8 bits per character, that number of total bits, and that's the full size if you represent it in the very standard way. It turns out we're going to be able to make it much smaller than this, without trying too hard. So here's what we're going to do first. Notice that at least when everything's in lowercase, there's only 32 different characters. There's only 32 different letters that they get used. So we can give each of them a shorter code than 8 bits. In fact, for a 5-bit code, how many different 5-bit patterns are there? Well, there's 00000, there's 00001, there's 00010. If we added all the different possible combinations together, how many would there be? I don't know, try it with 3 if you have 3. 000, 001, 010. Here 11, 100, 101, 110, 111, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So if we had 50-bit codes. There are 8 of them. But we have 32 different letters that we need to be able to represent. So we can't get by with just 3 bits. How about 4 bits? How many do we get with 4 bits? Well, we get all of these 8, all with a 0 in front of them. And we get the same 8 again with a 1 in front of them. So 16. So 4-bit codes. There are 16 unique codes. Okay. We've got 5-bit codes. Should double it again, right? One more bit out front. Means we can represent all the 4-bit codes with a 0 in the front and all the 4-bit codes with a 1 in the front for a total of 32. All right, so we've got for 5-bit codes, there are 32 patterns. If we just assign each of those patterns one of the letters, then we should be fine. So what would we get in that case? We'd get 5 bits per character. I said on the previous slide how many characters there were, how many letters there were in the Gettysburg Address. So 5 times that gives you 7,410 total bits, which is now less than 2/3 the size. So now we took the whole Gettysburg Address and we shrunk it to about 2/3 as big as it was before, without losing any information, right? We still have the Gettysburg Address, it's just that we can only represent things that just use the characters from the Gettysburg Address, just the letters, a couple punctuation symbols, etc. So here's, for example, here's a reasonable way of assigning 5-bit patterns to each of the letters. We'll say that 0000 is space, 0001 is a break. We'll say that G is 01100, right? As long as every letter gets a code, then we're fine. If we want to represent the word hi, H-I, I should tape this to my head or something. So the word hi, H-I, is the code for H, which is 01101, followed by the code for I, which is 01110. Right? So if we're sending this in bits, or we're storing this in bits, this would be a reasonable way to do it. This would stand for the word hi. So let's make sure that you get this. Here's what I'll do. I'm going to write one. 01. Okay, so that is a message from me to you. So which of these did I write using this encoding, this code that I have right up on the screen right now? Hang on a second. I'm going to let you click it in. No, it's not D. Plans and all that. Let's try this. Right, the choices are on the board, not on the screen. Well, if nothing else, we'll see who's paying attention. Who knows how to use their clickers? Oh, I clicked on the wrong clicker. All right, 5 more seconds. Spent too much time already. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, stop. All right. We'll do another one of these when the code gets more interesting. Oh, good. Thank you. So there's 2 ways you could have gotten that one right. One is by actually answering it, and the other is by listening. to other people answering it. But the reason this is okay is because each letter is 5 bits. So take the first 5 bits and the second 5 bits. First 5 bits, you look it up,
and it's not visible.
It's O, right? 10100, and this is K, 10000. So this is okay, okay. So moving on. All right, but that's just one way of doing it. In fact, we're not going to be able to get it any smaller using codes like that. Here's the cool idea. This is the part that I think is kind of fun to think about. Some characters are much more common than others. Give me an example of a common character in the Gettysburg Address, or in English more generally. What's a letter you think you see a lot?
E.
E, excellent. And that's good if you're, say, playing Wheel of Fortune, right? I mean, it's the sort of thing that comes up a lot in English, whereas, I don't know, what's a rare letter? Q. X. Right. So there's some letters that you just wouldn't expect to come up very often. They're the ones that tend to have high scores in Scrabble. They're the ones that you would just be silly if you guessed in Wheel of Fortune, etc. All right. So what we're going to do is we're going to use variable length codes. We're going to make the letters that appear a lot, we're going to give them very short codes. And the letters that appear more often, or less often, we're going to give longer codes to. Not because we want them to be longer, but because it's not going to matter much, because they don't appear very often. So here's one way of doing it. We're going to come up with a better way, but just to show you that this is actually a useful and clever idea, we're going to take the 4 most common characters from the Gettysburg Address and just make up 3-bit codes for them. And all the rest of them are going to get 6-bit codes, the remaining 28. So let's think of how many bits that we need now. Well, if we're only representing rare letters, we need a lot more bits. We need 6 bits per letter instead of 5. But if we're representing the Gettysburg Address, you'd expect it to go down. So here's how it's going to work. I made up a code. So here's the first. Turns out these are the 4 most common: space, E, T, and A. So E is the first of the actual letters. But we have to represent spaces too. So that's, and then they're very common. So I'll say 000 is space, 001 is E, 010 is T, and 011 is A. 4 of them. And everybody else is going to get the 6-bit code. And I just made up a bunch of 6-bit codes. There's some 6-bit codes that don't have any letters associated with them. But every letter needs to have one of the codes. All right. So, first thing to notice is I should be able now to write a short message and let you decode it. So let me try this. So don't yell this one out right away. So that's how many bits is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 12 bits. Is it?
No,
it's not actually. Well, I don't think it is. But it is weirder than the other one. Let me make sure that I didn't make a mistake. So this is it's 0101, then 4 zeros, then 1001. This is pronounced nah. All right. Can I put a butt? Oh, it's not all the way up. Oh, that's a little tricky. So while the timer's can we do this? Now we can't see. We just clicked in, but I'm going to give you a couple more seconds to do this. I need a couple seconds to do this.
It still seems to be counting. I'll turn it back on.
Need a little more time?
Yeah.
All right, I mean, if you're baffled, it's okay. I'll tell you the answer in a couple seconds. All right, I'll go 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Stop.
All right, so this is what's weird about variable length codes, right? You can't just look at this and say, oh, there's 12 bits, we'll just put it into blocks. It's not so easy anymore. It's hard to tell where, say, the second character starts. But here's what you can do. If you notice, I made the 3-bit codes all different from the 6-bit codes. How did I do that? How can you tell them apart? If it starts with a 0. So you look at the very first character and you say, okay, or very first bit, it's a 0. That means the first 3 bits are one of the letters. I don't even know what letter it is yet. The next one starts with a 1, so that way we know it's a 6-bit code. And the last one starts with a 0, so we know it's a 3-bit code. All right, now we can actually go and figure out what they are. 010 is T. Well, now we're done, right? 1 and then a bunch of zeros, 1 is H, and 001 is E. So this is the, and one of the reasons I picked the is because it's made out of fairly common letters. It ends up having a shorter code than, say, OK. In this case, OK takes 12 bits, and the takes 12 bits, even though it's one character longer. Pretty neat. All right, so let's see if that came through for everybody. D, was that the? Oh, good. All right, so yes. So there's a variable length code. So I did choose the code carefully so you could tell whether it was a long or a short, and that means that you can actually decode things, that here's hi there, written out in bits, and you can see that because it starts with a 1, the first thing is a 6-bit character, that's the H. The next one starts with a 1, that's another 6-bit character. Next one starts with a 0, that's the space, and so on. So, to write hi there with a period takes 42 bits in this code instead of 45, which is what we get if it took 5 bits per character. It is a bit harder to work with, right? Because I can't just point to a place in the string and you don't know whether this is the beginning of a character or not unless you go all the way through left to right. But still, it is smaller. We saved a little bit. H I space T H E R E. Period. All right, so what's going on here? We took all 32 characters, we had already given them 5-bit codes, now we've got 4 that are 3-bit codes and 28 that are 6-bit codes. So more than half of the characters have actually gotten longer. So intuitively, that seems like not a good idea if we're trying to compress. But what matters is that we have to take into consideration how many of each character there are. And so when we go to add up how many total bits it takes to write the Gettysburg Address, let's do it by character. The first thing we do is, well, how many bits does it take to write all the Y's that are in the Gettysburg Address? Well, there are 10 of them, and each one takes 6 bits. So there's 60 bits just to represent the Y's in the order. It used to be 50, so that's actually gotten longer, so that's bad. But what about the letter T? There's 126 T's in the Gettysburg Address, and each one now takes 3 bits. So there's only 378 bits when you go to write the whole thing out. 378 of those bits are dedicated to representing the letter T each time it appears. Previously, when we used 5-bit codes, it was 630. This is a lot smaller. So if we wanted to find out how many bits it takes to write the whole Gettysburg Address, we could painstakingly go through, look up the first character, count up the bits, look up the second character, count up the bits. But we can do it faster than that. If let's say C is one of the characters, we're going to say frequency of C is the number of times it appears in the Gettysburg Address, and len C is how long it is in bits in our encoding. So the total bit is going to be the sum over all characters of the number of times that character appears times how long that character is. We sum that up for all the characters, and that's the total number of bits in the whole Gettysburg Address. So if we go to do that, it looks something like this. We have 282 spaces, 165 E's, 126 T's, and so forth. So we take 282 times the 3 bits it takes to write a space, plus 165 times the 3 bits it takes to write an E, plus 126 times the 3 bits it takes to write the T,
plus 102 times the 3 bits it takes to write an A, then 93 times 6, because it takes 6 bits to write an O, plus 80 times 6, plus 79 times 6, plus 77 times 6, and so forth all the way down the alphabet like that. Okay? When you go and sum all these up, it ends up totaling to 6,867 bits for the Gettysburg Address. Is that good or bad? Well, now, the 6,867 bits represents a total of 1,482 characters, so that's 4.6 bits per character on average, right? We don't have 0.6 bits anywhere. But on average, by character, the Gettysburg Address takes 4.6 bits per character. That's less than the 5 when we did it in a straightforward way, and it's much less than the 8 if we do it in ASCII, so we actually got a compression of more than 60%. Not a compression, we compressed down to about 60% of the total length. So that's progress. So working with these variable length codes could actually be really, really useful. Well, here's another idea. What if we do it this way? What if we sort all the characters in order of their frequency, and we assign the shortest code to the first one, and the second shortest code to the third one, and the third shortest code to the third one, and so on. So E, or a space is 0, E is 10, T is 110, A is 1110, and so forth. We end up with 7.1 bits per character. Total of 10,467 bits. We got a little bit of compression over ASCII, but it's actually longer than the fixed width code of 5 bits per character. So this was not a good idea. So there's better and worse ways of using your variable length encodings. So we could, for example, make up our own code and see how it works out. Let's see. What are we doing on time? The clock.
You have 17 minutes.
All right. So I'll put that off for the moment. But we could then just go through and kind of use our intuition to kind of make up a code. We'll probably want the short codes to be with the frequent characters, and the longer codes to be with the less frequent characters. We need to make sure it's decodable. We need to make sure that you can tell, reading left to right, when the character is going to end. You know what I mean by that? So you can't have, for example, a code that looks like this. Let's say E we're going to have as the bit 1, and A we'll have as the sequence 1-1. Now if I give you something that looks like this, you can't tell what this is. You can't tell if it's AA, or it could be EEEE, or it could be EAE. So even though they're different codes, you can't tell where they stop. And so we have to do things like this, so that we can tell them apart as we read left to right. So this can only be one thing now. This is EAE. All right, so here's a cute little story that I heard once upon a time. There was a guy named Claude Shannon who invented what's called information theory. He invented a theory that puts together bits and randomness and encoding and statistics and all kinds of very clever things, and it's the basis for a lot of the way that we computer scientists think about transmitting information and making up codes and a whole lot of other things. Probability theory is very different now based on Shannon's information theory. So Shannon was this guy. He worked for a while at AT&T. He was also a professor at MIT for a while. He worked with another professor at MIT, a guy by the name of Fano, and they worked together on this problem that I just posed informally a moment ago, which is finding a minimal size code. If you have something like the Gettysburg Address, you want to come up with a code that respects how frequent each of the characters are, so that the small ones are short and the common ones are short and the rare ones are longer, but you want to do it just right so you get the most possible compression. So they worked on this problem together and they didn't solve it. They did find a rule of thumb that was very good, but they didn't actually get the optimal code, or a procedure for actually always determining the optimal code. Now, Fano was a professor, and a lot of MIT professors are kind of, I don't know, I would say ball buster, but I don't know if there's a better word for it than that. They're just really tough, and a little bit on the arrogant and obnoxious side. So he actually assigned this problem to his class. He actually said to everybody, figure out a procedure for finding the optimal code, assuming that his class would, at best, probably they wouldn't come up with anything, but if they came up with anything, they would come up with the same answer that he and Shannon had already published, which was a not correct answer, but it was a very reasonable one. So Huffman, this guy Huffman, was a student in that class, and he took it home, and he worked on it, and he solved it, and he brought it back, not knowing, in fact, that this was an open problem that nobody had solved, and in fact, his professor, specifically who assigned the problem, hadn't solved it, but he solved it, and he wrote it up, and the code now bears his name. They're called Huffman codes. So I just think that's neat, because, students. All right, so here's the first thing that you need to understand to get a handle on Huffman encodings. And that's this. What we're going to do is represent the code as a tree. Now remember trees? They've got a root, and then they branch, and then at the bottom there's leaves. So here, this is our code tree. So here's what we're going to do. Pick a letter, say E. What's the code for E given this tree? Well, we start out at the root, and we make a path to E. We go left, in this case, left, right. Each left we're going to use as the bit 0, and each right we're going to use as the bit 1. So E is going to be 0, 0, 1. We'll try another one. Here's G. All right, so how do we get to G? To get to G, we go 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0. I just picked out a random, but it turned out to be kind of interesting. All right, so how many bits was that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 bits for G. The space over here is 0, 0, 0, just 3 bits, and so on. In fact, I think this may be the code that I came up with, not an optimal code. All right, so, then here's W is 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, and so forth. If you have a bit sequence and you want to know what letter it is, you say, all right, let's say, what is the bit sequence 101100? So that would be, you start at the root, and you go right because it's a 1, then left because it's a 0, then right because it's a 1, then right because it's another 1, then left because it's 0, left because it's 0, that's a V. Okay? So you should be able to go in both directions now. The tree structure is really helpful because it means if I give you a sequence of bits, you can trace it out and figure out what character it is. You know that you're not going to get stuck in this problem of two different sequences being interpreted in two different ways. So everything is unambiguous this way. So now we're stuck with the problem of finding the best tree. All right, there's E, there's W. All right. So I'm going to say very briefly in words how the Huffman coding algorithm works, and then I'll step you through it because it's a little easier to understand when you just see it step by step. So we're going to make each character initially a subtree, and it's going to have a count, which is equal to the number of times it appears in the collection. We're going to take the two subtrees or blocks that have the smallest counts and merge them into a tree by putting left and right branches over them. The count for the new tree is the sum of the counts of the trees that it's made up of. And we're just going to keep doing this until we get one big tree. And then we've got the code. So how does this actually go? So here's a partial example. These are some of the characters from the Gettysburg Address along with their count, and how we successively merge them to get a tree. So we start off, we say, all right, there's comma, there's 22 commas, 21 U's, 15 dashes, 15 P's, 14 B's, 13 M's, and so forth. All right. So the first step of this algorithm says take the whatever letters have the smallest counts, which in this case are K and Q, which have counts of 3 and 1 together, and merge them into a little tree. So here's a little tree that we're going to make now. We'll just make the left branch the K and the right branch the Q. All right. We'll put a count on that, which is the sum of the 3 and the 1, or 4. And then we're done that step. Now we're going to repeat that operation again. Notice that there's now one fewer things in the list. There were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Now there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. This is a unit. This is 9, and then 10. Each time we do this merging, we get one fewer things until we get one big tree. All right, so the next step says whichever blocks have the two smallest counts, we're going to merge them together in a tree. So in this case, it's the line break and this tree that's K and Q together. We put them together. Here's the tree that we get from that. Down one branch, it's got the K and the Q. Down the other branch, it's got the line break. The total here is now 8, 4 plus 4. All right, again, which two things have the smallest counts? We've got the Y that's at 10, and this merged tree, which is 8. So we merge those together. It looks like this. one branch is the Y, and the other branch is the KQ and the line break altogether. The total for this now is 18, 10 plus 8. If we look at the sorted order now, we get comma, U, and then this whole block sums up to 18, then 15, 15, 14, 13, 10. So the next thing that we merge are the M and the period, because they're the ones with the smallest counts. Merge them together, here they are. M on the one side, period on the other. That now has a total, these guys have a total of 23, the 13 plus the 10, and sorted. All right, we go back over to here. Now we look at the two smallest, our P and B. We merge those together, here they are, they have a count of 29. Sort them again, now the smallest ones are this block, which is 18, and the dash, which is 15. So we merge them together, like this. We get a total of 33. It's actually the biggest block we've got at the moment. The smallest ones are comma and U. We merge those together. We just keep doing this until everybody's in one big happy clump. What number, what's the total that's going to be associated with that final tree? To see if you were listening. Right? Each time we merge two things together in a tree, we sum up the counts of the things that we're merging. So once we've merged everybody, what's the grand total going to be for that whole big tree? Not the number necessarily, but how would I figure out that number? I could step through all the steps, but there's a shortcut. Not sure? Since each time we merge together two things under each of them with their counts, the count of a tree is always the sum of the counts on the leaves. And so if we have one tree that has everybody, it's just going to be the sum of all these numbers across the bottom.
122.
Which may or may not be 122. All right. So presumably that you were thinking that through. I'm not sure exactly what the number is. Maybe it is that. But where it comes from is just the sum of those smaller numbers. All right. So for the Gettysburg Address example that I've been using as an example as we go, this is the tree that you end up with. We end up with a code for every letter. Some of the codes are bigger than others. Let's take something like a common letter, like E. Let's look at its code. It didn't quite fit on the slide, so I kind of put a piece of bread here. But this is 1, 0, 0 is E, so it gets a 3-bit code. Whereas with something that's long, like Q, there's only one Q in the whole thing. That gets a code that's how long? Let's see, 1, 2. It's kind of merged. So there's a gap there, but you can't see it. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10 bits. It takes 10 bits to write down a Q in this code, which seems very, very long. But the fact of the matter is, we've made E really short. We've made H and R fairly short. Space is very, very short. Actually, space is what? 1, 1. 2 bits to represent a space. So it's been compressed even more. And this is the optimal such tree. This is the output of Huffman's algorithm. And this is the code that you get. So space is 2 bits, E is 3 bits, T is 4 bits, A, O, H, R, they're all 4 bits. Then there's a bunch of 5-bit codes, and then a bunch of 6-bit codes, 7-bit codes, and then we get the Q, which is a 10-bit code. But then all the letters get a code, and we can decode from this. We should be fine. So let's look at what we get for this example. The total for this example, to represent the whole Gettysburg Address, which I got by taking the frequency for each letter, how many times does it appear in the Gettysburg Address, times however many bits long its code is in the Huffman code, total that up, I got 6,135, or an average of 4.1 bits per character. It's almost half the size of the original encoding. So we've taken the big Gettysburg Address and shrunk it to half the size. Now the Gettysburg Address really isn't that long, but if we had imagine storing, a big chunk of the web. I mean, there's all sorts of examples that you can think of where you'd like to be able to store. I mean, cutting it in half is a really good thing, right? You basically get twice as much stuff for the same cost. All right, so this is the best possible character-by-character code for this passage. All right, so we're at still no time on the clock thing. We're 37. Okay, so we're almost done. So I want to say just a couple of words about some other encodings. There's a whole field that just thinks about how do you take different things and turn them into codes. These Huffman codes are really useful, but there's lots of other codes as well. There's also error detecting codes. Good thing about an error detecting code is when you go to transmit bits from one place to another, sometimes they get a little noisy, you can't quite tell what they are, and they might end up, a zero might come out on the other end as a one. If you really take everything that you receive completely at face value, you just say, oh, I guess that's a different bit now, and everything gets messed up after that, especially if you have a really tight encoding. That can really have a big impact. So error detecting codes basically tell you that if something like one bit flip has happened. It's a code that indicates, hey, something's wrong, one of my bits got flipped. I don't know which one, but you need to send that to me again because it didn't come through correctly. An error correcting code actually tells you which bit is flipped, and you can flip it back. So the thing gets transmitted, it gets messed up in transmission, and on the other side somebody says, this got messed up, I'll just fix it. These are explained in some detail in the chapter. There's also multi-character encodings where you actually encode sequences, like the word the gets its own special code. It's not just T followed by H followed by E. You can actually get much possible to the minimum possible encoding length when you do this, which is called the entropy of the sequence. Compression algorithms like ZIP, people know ZIP compression, but there's things you do on your computer where you take a file and it makes it smaller. They generally use these kinds of multi-character encodings. All right, so another kind of encoding that comes up a lot if you're talking about discrete sequences like this, like a bunch of colors, is what's called run length encoding, where what you actually do is you say, all right, we've got blue, 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 red, red, yellow, 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 white, red, 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 red. If you're encoding things where there tends to be a lot of repetition, one way to compress this is by saying, all right, here's what the sequence is. It's the letter, it's blue four times. So you just say blue 4, right? Followed by red 2, followed by yellow 3, followed by white 1, followed by red 4. If there's a lot of repetition in the sequence, you can compress things tremendously, right? Because a very long sequence of blues, for example, just becomes blue followed by a number. It's logarithmically compressed, right? Because the number of bits you need to write a count of size n is log n. So things can shrink an awful lot when you do that. Sort of, this is an easier code to think about, I think, for a lot of people than the Huffman encoding that I showed you where there's all these trees and things you have to worry about. But they are still pretty powerful. So what's neat about this is you can actually, with the same number of bits, you can potentially represent more stuff if you come up with the right encoding. All right, pretty good. So for Wednesday, we're going to finish chapter 4. Just hop back a little bit, talk about heuristics and empty completeness, and then we should be done with that. And I might ask some quicker questions about this chapter 6 now that you've got some warning to read it.